But if you look at this carnivore mechanism, this carnivore dynamic, this oppositionality, the only thing that mitigates carnivore, it's a natural response carnivore. It's difficult for plants to handle, even in under the best of circumstances. But it's totally manageable as long as the kid is trying to attach to you. And it's not how much you love the child. That's given that you love the child. It's given that you'll do anything for the child. What's not given is that the child wants to attach to you. That's what you have to invoke here. When a child is trying to attach to you, that mitigates their carnivore. You're much less likely to enforce somebody that you're trying to attach to. And so, again, the answer to oppositionality is relationship. Not more pressure, because as Wayne demonstrated, when I pushed harder, he pushed harder back. And that's exactly where our kids come. Now, I could go on and talk about the learning problems, which is, you know, another whole other subject, but let me tell you a little bit about what peer orientation does to children's development, and it's a total disaster. It's a total disaster. The first thing that happens to peer children is that they shut down emotionally. What's the ethic in the peer group? To be cool. Nothing matters. Nothing matters. They just shut down their emotions. They don't do it. Their brains does it. Why do their brains do it? Because human beings are profoundly vulnerable. Vulnerare, from the Latin word, to wound. Human beings are physically and emotionally profoundly vulnerable for a lifetime. There's nothing your brain can do to protect you from being vulnerable. What the brain can do is to shut down the painful, overwhelming awareness of your vulnerability. And the brain sometimes has to do that. When does it have to do it? Well, in the case of abused kids. So my downtown east side patients are profoundly shut down emotionally. And when that's not enough, they turn to the narcotics to kill the pain. And because they're shut down, they're bored, not interested, alienated, now they have to do stimulants to get them excited about life again. But if you don't understand the crystal meth epidemic, for example, crystal meth is an interesting drug. It releases a chemical called dopamine in the brain. Dopamine is necessary for motivation, for incentive, for a sense of being alive, for interest, for curiosity. And it's a chemical without which you can't function. Without it, we were kind of zombies without it. If you see that movie Awakening, those people lacked dopamine, so they became like zombies. Now, people abuse, well, the brain will shut down emotional awareness just to protect them from the overwhelming sense of vulnerability. But that's also what happens with peer-oriented kids. Why? Because what children need is unconditional loving acceptance. That's what they need. The peer world cannot possibly provide that. It's not designed by nature to provide it. They're too immature. It's not that kids are cruel, it's that they're immature. So they behave in cruel ways. But not because they're intrinsically cruel, simply because they're immature. So once a child becomes peer-oriented, and being that the peer world is a tough one, there's a lot of dissing, there's a lot of ostracization, bullying, criticism, physical attacks, verbal attacks, how does the brain protect the child? By shutting down emotionally. When you shut down emotionally, let's look at what happens to learning. Well, what drives learning? The thing that drives learning most of all, more than anything else, is curiosity. The two-year-old is curious about everything. They learn more than anybody does in a quicker period of time. Because they're curious, and they're open-minded. But curiosity, and anyone as a teacher is in the room will know, that a curious child is a joy to teach. There's very little you have to do. Just give them material, give them information. But curiosity is a vulnerable emotion. Because when you're curious, you have to admit that you don't know. And that's vulnerable. These kids who are parented, they know everything. You've talked to some of these kids, they know everything. Oh yeah, I know. Oh no, I understand. Oh yeah, I heard that. It's a shutdown. So curiosity no longer works in the favor of the teacher, because these kids are emotionally shut down. Well, how else do people learn? People learn by attaching to somebody and wanting to learn from them, wanting to emulate them. Well, that's great. But the kids who are parented are doing that to each other, not to the teacher. So they're emulating each other. Attachment commands the attention. You know, when you fall in love, where does your attention go? Should the person that you're interested in walk into the room, you know, everything else disappears from your field of vision. Purely the children in the classroom very often don't pay attention, not because they have ADD per se, but because they're too attached to their peers, or they're paying attention already to who's wearing what, who's going out with whom, who's fighting with whom, who's in, who's out. That's what they're paying attention to. So in every way, and I can say more ways in which parentation undermines learning as well. Precocious sexuality. Oh, by the way, so crystal meth, I was telling you about it. So crystal meth releases dopamine in the brain, right? So does any activity that involves seeking or curiosity. So food seeking, or the expectation of food, will increase your dopamine levels in the reward centers of the brain by 50%. Sexual seeking or expectation will increase your dopamine levels by 100%. A shot of cocaine will increase your dopamine levels by 300%. And a shot of crystal meth will increase your dopamine levels by 1,200%. Now if you take these kids who are bored and inanimated and pure-oriented, and they do crystal meth, boy, life becomes interesting and exciting. Do you blame them for using the stuff? Nah, it's a natural response. Again, the problem is not the behavior. The problem is the fundamental dynamics underlying the behavior. And drug education in the schools, again, falls on deaf ears. Why? Because the kids that need to hear it are not the ones listening. The kids that are listening don't need to hear it so much. I'm not against it. I'm just saying that it misses a big part of the puzzle, because the kids who most need to hear it are the ones who are not listening to adults already. And they're the ones most at risk. So it doesn't matter how many beautiful ads the health ministry takes out in the newspapers about the evils of crystal meth. It doesn't matter if those kids don't read it. And if the parents read it, that's fine, but the parents are no longer in touch with their kids. So, the solution as well, first of all, the prevention, which is keep your kids closed. Vouchsafe and honor the family structures, the family events. They need to be written in stone, family meals, which are not about watching TV together, but about relating together. You know, I was in Spain last year. It's totally crazy. The clients are totally nuts. You go for lunch at the restaurant in Barcelona, it's closed. It's closed for lunch. You know what those crazy parents are doing? They're home with their families having lunch. Imagine the effrontery of it, you know? So the family meals, the weekends. When you have weekend activities, don't invite your peers, the kids' peers. It's easy for you, yes, because kids babysit each other, but you're paying a price. And very often when you see these days, even when families get together, the kids will be playing each other and the parents will be talking to each other, blessedly enjoying their respite. That's great, but you're buying trouble later on. So do things with your kids and leave the peers out of it as much as possible. This is with the young kids I'm talking about. Forget the play dates. They're not necessary. Forget this idea that you socialize your kids. You don't socialize your kids. Socialization happens spontaneously with maturity. The studies actually show that, I'm not here to speak about homeschooling and to advocate it, because I would have been the world's worst homeschooling teacher. But homeschool kids who spend more time with their parents actually make better and deeper friendships later on. Why? Because they mature. Because the emotional kid, the shutdown that happens with orientation, stops development. Because development happens along the tender, vulnerable edge of emotional openness. That's where growth happens. It's the same thing in nature. Trees or plants grow along that tender, vulnerable point. Crustacean animals who are surrounded by a hard shell, if they need to grow, they need to come out of their shell and make themselves very vulnerable. It's only when you're vulnerable that you develop. When you shut down against vulnerability, you stop developing. So these kids stay immature. So now you see 24, 25-year-olds still totally immature emotionally. And the result is the peer culture that you watch on television, which is unbearably immature. the reality shows and the gossip shows, and I mean, it's a cultural crime because of the orientation and the lack of maturity of our young adult population as a result of orientation. Now, I'm not going to say a whole lot because I'm going to stop and answer questions and discussion. But in terms of kids who are already peer-oriented, what do you do? Well, here's what you need to do. First of all, you have to look at your own life. See, if somebody looked at my life when my kids were small or even in their early teens, adolescents, and they would have asked me, what is my highest value? I would have said, my highest value is the happiness and growth of my children. But if they looked at my life and tried to gauge, not from what I said and what I believe, but from what I did, what my values were, they would have seen a workaholic physician who was all too happy to take on more and more responsibility and all wanted to be important in the world. That's what they would have seen. And who was not happy on the weekend unless the beeper went to show him how important he was. And if anybody had asked me, you know, I would have said that yes, I would throw myself into a fire for my kids. And of course I would have. But you know what the problem was? That nobody ever needed me to throw myself into a fire. They just needed me to be at home as an emotionally present, non-stressed parent, and that I didn't give them. So you have to look at how you live your life, because when you're stressing yourself about a whole lot of things, you can't be there as a parent, because it's not what you do, but who you are that really makes a difference. You can do all the right things, but if you're not there emotionally present, and if you're stressed out, you just ain't going to be able to get across to the child that he or she is the most important thing in your universe, which is the message that all children need. So if you have a problem with the kids, first of all, look at how you live your life. How is your relationship with your spouse? There's a lot of tension at home. The kids pick up on it. You gotta deal with it. You gotta deal with it. And then, you have to believe me when I tell you that even the most pure-oriented and recalcitrant oppositional child needs you more than anything else in the whole world. That in his heart, whether he knows it or not, in fact he doesn't know it consciously, that's what he needs, is a strong relationship with you. That you're still the child's best bet, doesn't matter what they do or what they think. And so that means that you cannot take their acting out and their oppositionality and their insults and their resistance personally. It's not about you. It's instinctual, based on how they're oriented. They cannot even help it. Don't take it personally. Don't feel hurt. Well, feelings of hurt will come up, but don't take them personally. They get triggered. But that's not the game here. The game here is that you're the most important fixture in this kid's life, whether he knows it or not. You need to have the confidence of that to put up with the rebuffs and put up with the resistances and the rejections. And you have to make time in your life to enjoy the kid. The biggest gift you can give your kids is to enjoy them. And that means you're going to do sometimes with them what they want to do. You might want to go fishing. They may want to play video games with you. Play video games, for God's sake. Don't, in fact, wait for them to invite you. You invite them. Hey, yeah, I'd love to play some video games with you. Lie through your teeth. When I say lie through your teeth, it's not really a lie. Because the full sentence is, I'd love to play some video games with you. Not that I'd love to play some video games. You might hate video games. But what you want most of all is contact with your kid. So it's totally true. I'd love to play some video games with you. So say it like you meant it. Get in their face in a friendly way, as Gordon says. Collect them before you correct them. If every time your spouse saw you, and the first thing he or she said to you was, did you do your work today? Were you on time to work? Did you get everything done? Is there any duties that you haven't completed today? What about tomorrow? How long would you stay in that relationship? But this is how we talk to our kids all the time. You've got to collect them first. Bring them under your wing. Relate to them about nothing in particular. Just about the relationship itself. After every... we do this with babies spontaneously, but then we lose it somehow. And the more we lose it, the more we actually lose our parenting instincts. And the more we lose our parenting instincts, the more we parent from books. This is not even the book to parent from, by the way. Our aim here is to awaken your parenting instincts and then to give you some broad outlines as to how to approach your kids. what to do will emerge from your own instincts once they're engaged. Once they're engaged. And the key thing, again, is to keep the relationship in mind. And anything that will undermine the relationship, don't do it. Homework. Don't get into a fight about it. Don't get into a fight about it. If it's going to undermine the relationship. The long-term goal has to be the relationship. Why? Because it's only in the context of the relationship that the child will develop into a healthy adult. It's that simple. You have to put the long-term developmental goal ahead of any short-term behavioral goals. So the kid is not doing their homework. You know what? There are natural consequences of not doing the homework. You don't have to impose them. Control and punish. I'm talking about 15, 16-year-old. You know, within 7, 8-year-old, you can get away with more. The stronger the relationship, the more pressure it will bear. The more you rebuild the relationship, the more you can press the kid. Why impress the kid? But don't expose the impotence by trying to force them to do things they will simply not do. It doesn't work in your favor. And when I said this, I gave the same advice after I wrote my first book on ADHD, and I was in Winnipeg for my book tour. And I told them, these kids hate, particularly the ADD kids, hate to do homework. And I said, you know, if it's going to undermine the relationship, forget it. You know, nobody dies of failing grade 10. Much better that, you know, in fact, in some families, it would be a great triumph if the child failed grade 10 and nobody freaked out about it. If the message was, you know what, you're still okay with that. So, let's go back to the drawing board. And I told you so and all of that. So when I said this about homework, but don't press the kid. If the doing so would undermine the relationship, the mother stood up and said, you know, I'm so glad to hear you say that. Because when I 15-year-old daughter's teacher phones me to tell me that she hasn't done her homework again, I say to the teacher, well, thanks for the information, but she also hasn't taken out the garbage, and I don't phone you to tell you about it. So, while on the one hand, there should be avoidance of battles at home and homework, at the same time, there ought to be a lot of communication, a lot of respectful communication between parents and the schools, a lot more than exists right now. Look, I'll finish here. I'm going to say a lot more. I'll answer questions after this, and those of you that wish to purchase books, I brought some along for you. The book is a bestseller in Canada. It's been published now in many languages around the world, from Korea to Germany to Brazil. Let me just finish with the very last paragraph from my book. Who's to raise our kids? The resounding answer, the only answer compatible with nature, is that we, the parents and other adults concerned with the care of children, must be their mentors, their guides, their nurturers, and their models. We need to hold on to our children until our work is done. We need to hold on, not for selfish purposes, but so that they can venture forth. Not to hold them back, but so they can fulfill their developmental destinies. We need to hold on to them until they can hold on to themselves. Thank you.
The
schools are a lot of ways of peer orientation factories. And in 2 weeks, first of all, ideally, in the morning, and this is what elementary school on, kindergarten on, the attention baton is passed on from the parent to the teacher in the morning. It gets passed back on to the parent in the evening. That means in the early years at least, there'll be a lot of contact and interaction between the parents and the teacher so that the kids see that. Because when kids attach to people that they see their parents are attached to, that's a healthy way of transferring attachments. Now, in terms of the adolescent child, who is already peer-oriented and spends the whole day in school, you have to collect them all over again. There's a lot of ways that we talk about that in here, but it's all about creating as much space as possible for non-agenda-driven interaction between you and the child. But the agenda is not that they should do this or they shouldn't do that. The agenda is simply that you're going to enjoy their presence. You're going to have to create that space in your life. So you have to put the family meals in place. You're going to have to put weekends into place when you get the heck out of town where there are no peers. And you don't bring any along either. And they'll be bored.
Well, you know, there's nobody there. Well, what am I going to do?
You know, like the parents are chopped liver, you know. You're going to have to put up with that insult of being a nobody. Create that attachment void in the child's brain, which then you can fill. You do that by not reacting to the acting out, but by actually trying to get the message and reacting to the message, not to the behavior. You do that by not, by the way, I see the look of almost discouragement on your face when you ask the question. I just need to reassure you about something, okay? And I'll do that by way of a story. When I was rewriting this book, this is not easy stuff to do, and you're going to lose it, you know, but that's okay. As long as you stick on the road and you'll succeed. And our 19-year-old daughter, who said real peer orientation issues and still does to some degree, we brought her along really beautifully in the last 4 or 5 years. But 4 years ago, when I was rewriting this book, and I was, you know, I'd taken a few months off work to write the book, but when I was rewriting it, I was working full-time as a doctor, pretty stressed. I was already planning my next book on addiction, and I was rewriting this book, Hold On To Your Kids. And one weekend, having spent the whole weekend working and ignoring my own needs and so on, my daughter Hannah, at that time 15, maybe 16, is downstairs watching television. She's got ADD, she hates doing homework, did very little toward high school. She's been watching television all day. And I come down and I say, turn that off now. It's 8 o'clock in the evening, Sunday evening. No, I won't. You won't turn it off? No. But you haven't done any homework, will you? That's my affair. You always told me that's my business. Just why don't you practice when you preach? She knows exactly what I preach. So at this point I lose it. And I say, well, then I'm going to turn it off for you. So I turn off the TV and I stand in front of it. You know? Conscious parenting at its best. And I said, are you saying you're not going to let me watch TV in my own home? I said, yep, that's exactly what I'm saying. Well, I'm going out to my grandparents. No, you're not. Are you saying you're not letting me go to my grandparents? I said, yep, that's what I'm saying. Then I'm calling the cops. You're calling the cops? Here, I'll call them for you. 911. You tell them your father won't let you watch TV after the whole weekend of no homework whatsoever. But I didn't know that the phone was actually on. 5 minutes later, it rings. Sir, this is the Vancouver Police. Is somebody there dial 911? Yes, officer, that was me. Well, what happened? I said, well, 15-year-old daughter, ADD, homework, television, you know. Well, so how's your daughter? Oh, she's fine. Are you sure she's fine? Well, you need to come over and check on it. By all means, you know, coming over. But, well, we'll have to do that, sir, because somebody dialed 911. Who's at home? Well, my daughter, myself, and our dog. My wife was out, and our son living at home at the time was at work. Well, please put the dog in another room so it doesn't lunge at us, and we'll be right over. Meanwhile, my son Daniel comes home from work, just after 8 o'clock, and shortly thereafter, the two cops arrive, this huge policeman and a smaller policewoman. And the policewoman takes Hannah upstairs to debrief her, and the policeman and I go to the kitchen where Daniel's preparing his supper. And I say to Hannah, listen, I know you'll be angry with me, but you say what happened, okay? So upstairs they go, and I tell the cop the story, and he nods his head, and he gets it. And then Daniel says, officer, I can tell you what actually happened here. Yes, said the officer. Yes, said Daniel. These people, what happened here is that these two people didn't know how to trigger each other. Oh, I get that, said the officer. And furthermore, said Daniel, this man over here writes best-selling books on how to parent. So you're going to blow it all over the place. By the way, when the cops left, I drove Hannah up to her grandparents where she watched television all the time. Now, however, when you do that, when you break the bridge between you and the child, because I'm the one that broke the bridge, you rebuild it. Go make them work for it. You do it. If you do all that over time, believe me, you put this stuff into practice, you're going to see a difference in 3 weeks. You're not going to see everything change in 3 weeks, but you can see a difference in tone, in the feeling in the home. If you get off the backs, if you open your heart, if you parent from your heart, about how much sense there should. So that's the first step. Okay? Now, there's a question behind
you. Yeah, you talked about maturing and you talked about the matrix, but a lot of folks say that when kids hit 13-year mark that you should start. I mean, you talk about keeping them close enough.
Yeah.
You talk about letting go and allowing them to get independence, but
yeah.
At what age in your experience, in your opinion, do they get to the point where they're mature?
Well, you see, that depends very much on the culture that they grow up in. In an Aboriginal culture, people reach maturity much earlier, at 13 or 14. Even Romeo and Juliet were about 15 years old in that play. Now imagine that, 15-year-olds today. But in our society, firstly, you've got to realize something. What they call the healthy teenage rebellion is not healthy rebellion at all. Healthy rebellion is about... It's true that in adolescence, the task of life is to become an independent person, or at least to move and take another giant step towards independence. Your own values, your own meanings, your own sense, your own spiritual path, whatever, you know. But that doesn't necessarily mean rejecting the parents' work. The kids who are doing this teenage rebellion today, it's got nothing with hormones or adolescence, it's got to do with their intensive orientation. Real individuation, becoming your own person, doesn't mean that I'm pushing away from you so that I can conform with another group. It means I'm going to be my own person no matter what. I'm going to hold on to myself in any context. If my friends think this and I think that, that's okay with me. If my friends dress that way and I want to dress this way, that's okay with me. That's not what we see in our culture. What we see is kids pushing away from our parents. So we think now our kids are becoming independent. No, they're not. They're just transferring independence to the peer group. And then we give up. We think our job has been done. We think now they're becoming independent. In fact, what we're saying in this book, if you want to promote independence, invite dependence. Maturity is something that happens spontaneously. You don't have to talk to a plant to either make it more mature, give it lessons. You just give it the right conditions. His job is to mature. Nature takes care of that. Maturation is a natural, instinct-driven, developmental goal. It'll happen if the conditions are right. All you have to do is provide the right conditions. So at what stage the kids become mature and independent depends totally on the quality of their relationship with the nurturing animals. The kids that have proper relationship with nurturing animals mature much more quickly. The kids that don't mature ever. And believe me, there are lots of adults walking around who are not at all mature. I mean, many of us are that way, you know, well into our graying years. So, maturation depends on the conditions. You don't have to promote it, you don't have to push them into independence. You invite their dependence so they feel secure and safe. Independence will happen naturally. There's a false idea in our society that we have to foster independence. You don't have to foster it, it happens spontaneously.
I'm just wondering, I like what you're saying here, but then I've got three boys and they're not all mature.
You think
the conditions are the
same? No, they're not.
They're not.
You think those kids are the same parents?
No.
Not well, you would know more than your husband, though, wouldn't you? How old are they? No, you can't. How old are the kids?
22.
Yeah. 19, 20. No. Does 22-year-old have any older kids in his family when he was born?
No.
So he was an only child for a while?
No.
Did the 17-year-old ever not have two older brothers? Were either the younger or the older one ever been the middle child? Were the stresses on your life exactly the same at the stage that each of those kids went to their stage of development? Was your relationship with your husband exactly the same? Do the kids trigger exactly the same feelings in you or the same responses? Do you see different parts of yourself in each kid? No two kids ever have the same parents. Okay, you got that? It's not the external things. It's not the toys, the clothes, the love of the parents, which is a given. The rules, those are the things that make the difference. It's who the parent is and what the overall context is. And that was very different for each of your children. Plus, there were different people to start with. They have different sensibilities. They react differently. Some may be more stolid, the other may be more sensitive. I mean, you know, even if the circumstances were exactly the same, they wouldn't be receiving them exactly the same way. So there's many, many different differences, very, very subtle but totally meaningful and decisive differences that shape the development of each child. Okay?
Do you support the contention that girls mature quicker than boys or go through these stages quicker than boys?
Earlier,
thank you.
Earlier, yeah. Well, some of these certain seem to. But again, the overall arc of development occurs in a context. And there's many, many girls that as being shown by the statistics on girl violence and bullying and all that, that they're not maturing all that well. So they certainly physically seem to mature quicker. And there's also something about girls, by the way, which is very, very subtle. And at some point I was going to write a book about boys and men, and so I did this research, and or at least I looked at the research literature. Boys get different parenting overall than girls do. Fathers are never the same with their boys as they are with their girls, or rarely the same. Girls get more softer nurturing than boys do. Boys are expected to be somewhat tougher and roughhouse types and less vulnerable emotionally than girls. There's a kind of a built-in bias that we all tend to have. I know how I react to my boys and to my daughter. There's a kind of softness that gets evoked in me, a tenderness, more with the girl than with the boys. It's completely unconscious and undeliberate on my part. That means that I'm not the same parent. So that has a bearing on how they mature for us. Now the problem is that in our culture, now with the intense peer orientation, which has really taken over. Look, there was a study done by a psychologist who looked at the diaries of girls written 50 years ago with diaries of girls written today. And what she found was that 50 years ago, girls' aspirations had to do with who they'd be and what kind of contribution they'd make to society when they grew up. Do you know what the main concerns today are? How they look and how the peers like them. Were you going to say something else? Okay. Yeah.
When you were talking about leaving peers home or behind and having quality time with your kids that not without peers,
yeah.
Is there like an age time frame through that, or is that just basically across the board from beginning
to end? You need to, even with the teenagers and the older, you need to take some space, which is going to be only time. Mm-hmm. You need to take some space. Because what you understand is that the culture is against you. There's an enemy in your home, it's called a TV set. Mm-hmm. It beams this terrible values into the house. It beams this siren song of seductive, meaningless, gibberish culture, pulling your kids away from you. And it's out there all around you. And the kind of village, the kind of structure that used to support the attachment of a child to you is no longer there. So it's almost like you against the world in a certain sense. So you can't afford to relax around it. Because the cultural context is not there that would allow you to do that. Parents 50 years ago would get away with a lot more negative stuff than we can get away with. Why? Not because they were better parents, but because there wasn't this other culture that would pull away the kids from the parents' authority. I'm not advocating the parenting practices of 50 years ago, far from it. But I'm saying that parents would get away with a lot of stuff that we cannot get away with because they didn't have the competition that we did. So yes, you have to maintain some space in your life where it's only you and then only the kids. Okay? As long as they're not fully adults.
I remember when my daughter was sort of in grade 10 and 11, she rather often just stay home with us and watch a movie. And I was thinking, you know, you should really be going out. I think as parents, you think, you know, they're going to be happier if they make those connections.
Yeah.
It's interesting that to hear all this.
Yeah, well, I understand you're thinking that way, but I would just say you must have done something right if that's what your daughter wanted to do. You know what? It's a very stressful world up here, world. Even though my daughter sometimes, you know, 19, she just needs to be with us because to decompress.
Yeah.
Because you can never be fully yourself in the peer world.
Right.
Until you're fully mature, you can't be yourself. You have to pretend to somebody. Mm-hmm. And that's stressful. It's hard to pretend to be somebody that you're not.
It's usually it's a fresh message that I'm hearing from you, because usually you hear the other thing that's out there.
We're living in an insane society.
I recently had spoke with a friend of mine who is in charge of teenagers with drug addiction problems.
Yeah.
And so she's sort of an expert on teenagers. She spends a lot of time working with them. And she asked me what my daughter was doing, and I said, well, she wanted to come home, you know, for the part of the summer. She said, doesn't she want to go with her friends to Europe or San Francisco? And I said, well, she kind of wants to just come home. And after that conversation, I was feeling as if that wasn't right.
Yeah.
So.
Which was right, her response or yours?
That was my response, just because I was...
Your response was that what? Your response was what wasn't right?
Well, that... No, my response was maybe, you know, I was fostering too much independence or dependence.
No. You see, the problem with your friend is... How old are you now, if I can ask?
40-something.
40. That means that your friend is about the same age?
She's 60.
60?
Yeah, she's about 15.
Wow. Okay. Because what we're seeing a lot is that the people who are in positions of authority now themselves grew up as very independent people. This has been going on since the Second World War. Mm-hmm. That's when it really began in a big way. Mm-hmm. The first real exudescence of period culture was the hippie culture of the 1960s, where kids said, don't trust anyone over 30. Yeah. And it's our tribe against their tribe, you know. That was the first fully, you know, full culturally articulated expression of it. So the 60-year-old may have herself grown up already somewhat period, and to her it seems natural. Mm-hmm. And it is normal. But you got to understand something. What's normal is not the same as healthy and natural.
Right.
If everybody in Surrey tortured their cats, then it would be abnormal not to torture your cats.
Yeah.
That would be the norm. But it would not make it healthy or natural. So your friend may be looking at things from the point of view of the norm, and confusing the norm with what's natural and healthy. We're saying that what's norm in this society is neither natural nor healthy. And again, congratulations. By the way, I suggest to your friend that she read my book on addiction. Hello.
You described the schools as factories of
period
orientation.
Yeah.
What would you change?
What would we change? What needs to be changed is that, and again, when we talk teachers, and teachers actually appreciate this message because it follows their own instincts. It really does. They need to get into the attachment game, not just the teaching game. They need to become important people in the teachers, in the students' lives, not just intellectually, but also emotionally. They need to open up their hearts. They need to smile. They need to foster relationships now. That doesn't mean they foster individual relationships and they meet outside of school. It means in the classroom, they need to be warm, nurturing presence. These kids just blossom with that. And the teachers that do that instinctively and intuitively, without even thinking about it, they're the teachers who have had no problem in their classrooms. So there needs to be a lot more sense of community in the school, a lot more sense of connection. Teachers need to mingle a lot more with their kids. Not that, you know, in the lunchroom, you stood, you know, they should sit with the kids.
And you do that here.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that.
Yes.
But then they're doing the right thing. And so they need to create this culture of attachment in the schools and, again, in connection with the parents as well. So that this, it's not that the school is one world and the home is another, but they're both parts of the same village. This is what we're advocating. Okay? Sorry, yeah, please.
I'm just wondering about same-sex schools versus
co-education. Yeah, I don't think I have anything intelligent to say about that.
Okay.
Which may hit you as a shock, but there's some issues I haven't studied, and I'm in favor of whatever works. You know, I grew up in Hungary where we didn't have same-sex schools at all. That was in grade 7 when we left. I think, from what I understand anecdotally, parents and teachers seem to feel that it does reduce some of the tension and some of the acting out when you have separate genders. I think more important are the quality of adult-child relationships than the gender issue. But, you know, I don't have a lot of experience. Okay? Yeah.
when you talk about babies not letting them cry and keeping them close to you, so do you let them sleep with you at night? Like when they, is that a form of detachment, or should you make them go in their own bed or stay with you, or?
What do you got feelings for you now?
Pardon?
What do you got feelings for you now?
Depends on when you get moved.
Oh, well, what do you got feelings for you?
Well, I love to fish.
Excellent.
But it's hard to sleep when you have to get moved.
Yeah, I mean, do you have a lot of kids close together?
Yeah, they're all 2 years apart. So
uh-huh.
I got some advice for that. Mm-hmm. Our men were born up with 5 of us, and now nobody, so enjoy going.
Yeah, you know, when you look at, you want to see happy kids, you know, when you see happy kids, go to the poorest areas of Mexico, where the Mayan tribe still live, under conditions of extreme economic deprivation. Kids are naive and open and happy and smiling and around. Why? Because they were never separated from their parents. The so-called primitive tribes in North America, too, the parenting wants to carry the kids everywhere they went. Kids are never out of physical contact with the parents. You put that in the first few years, you're set for life. So I would say, and again, it's not the kids' agenda that created this grieving culture where, you know, son and both parents have to be out very eyed to go to work in the morning. It's not their problem. So if you're asking me ideally, if I did my parenting over again, those kids would be in the bed with us. That's what I would say. And, you know, you don't have to be worried. By the time they're 18, they don't want to be in that bed. All right. Any other questions? Yeah.
It's not really a question, but it's kind of wrong because I was at my parents for dinner, and I was like, well, got to get to school, and they go, what's the hurry in school? So we're going to listen to the talk about parenting and behavior and all that. And my dad just perked up and said, what's to know about it? All you got to do is spend time with them. They'll learn from you, you learn from them, and it's as simple as that.
Gosh, you know, I hope your dad doesn't say that too loudly, otherwise nobody will buy a book. but let me read you something here. Senior generations, parents and grandparents of the baby boomer group, look at us with the comprehension. We didn't need hard manuals on parenting in our days. We just did it, they say. And what your father doesn't get is that the context has changed. Okay, he still imagines that it's the same context. But he's totally right. Yeah. Well, for those of you that wish to purchase books, they're $20 each, and I'm happy to sign them for you. And for everybody else, thanks a lot for your attention.